Please be seated. The next case on the court's calendar is Thomas Crump v. State, case number 63346. Mr. Buscetta.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Michael Buscetta. I'm representing Mr. Crump in this matter. We have hurled quite a lot of briefing at the court. There's no way in 15 minutes I can even touch on most of it. But I think the salient points that this court should be concerned about are innocence of the death penalty, the invalid aggravating factor, both invalid aggravating factors, and the overwhelming amount of mitigation evidence that was not presented or investigated. This court, in its previous decision in 2006, recognized that the depravity aggravator was constitutionally invalid. And although that is, according to the Supreme Court in Stringer v. Black, a vague aggravating factor is the worst kind because it allows the jury to express all of its non-narrowing and non-rational emotions into the sentencing determination, the court didn't reverse. Now we come back and there is a felony murder aggravating factor that was also found, one of three found by the jury, depravity, felony murder, robbery, and prior convictions, that is invalid under McConnell and also invalid under Ney versus State. So we now have an innocence of the death penalty claim based on having three aggravators now down to one. And under this court's decision in Leslie and under Sloop versus Dello and House versus Bell, that requires this court to consider all of the evidence before it, including all of the evidence that we have presented to this court in this latest petition.
But does this excuse the procedural defaults?
Yes.
Why?
It does.
Why does it?
It's the gateway claim that if there is, either under Leslie or under Schlute, a question about the prejudicial effect of these two invalid aggravating factors, then that's the gateway into consideration of any of the defaulted claims, because all of the evidence has to be considered in assessing.
Brought up in one of the prior habeas petitions, and it was determined that the aggravating circumstance, even if it was invalid, it wouldn't demonstrate any prejudice. And so I'd like you to address that.
That was one aggravating factor. Now we have two aggravating factors. And this court said, in Homick and other cases, every factor makes the offense more heinous. And so when we're looking at a jury faced with this number of aggravating factors and saying, okay, do we find death eligibility? And when we get to the selection phase, if we get to the selection phase, are we going to actually impose a death sentence? And that is something which, in determining whether a reasonable Nevada jury, which, remember, is a reasonable Nevada jury, an impartial Nevada jury, under Bennett versus State, which never has to impose a death sentence, ever, no matter how great the aggravation is, no matter how little the mitigation is, that's the focus of the analysis, is it reasonably probable that a jury would have found that to make a difference.
What aggravation do we have left? What aggravating factor?
The prior conviction aggravating factor. And that, although I dispute its application because it is one of the prior convictions, which is a prior conviction only under Gallego versus State, it didn't happen prior. It wasn't a conviction that was entered before the commission of the crime. Now, this court rejected that claim on the direct appeal, I believe. But I still suggest that that is an incorrect reading of the aggravating factor, and that Gallego was in error in holding that, because the language used by the legislature in defining this previously convicted of aggravating factor. That is exactly the language that's used in the prior conviction recidivist statute, where it is clear that under the law at the time, the prior conviction had to have been a conviction before the commission of the new offense. We also have, in this case, the use of a Caslon-type instruction before the decision in Caslon. And we've submitted a Rule 31 statement of additional authority, referring the court to Riley, which is a case decided by the Ninth Circuit, where the Ninth Circuit said, well, before this court changed the law in Caslon and accepted the terms of that instruction as the definition of first-degree murder in Nevada, the existing authority was Hearn, which rejected that instruction. So at this point, we now also have an invalid definition of premeditation, which was one of the things that counsel did litigate at trial, or at least argue. And in addition to the intervening authority of NECA, this is one of the claims that any purported procedural default would be overcome in the context of considering this as part of the actual innocence of the death penalty issue. But the most problematic...
Can Riley essentially just restate the law as it was in Hearn?
No.
Tell me why it doesn't.
Because the whole instantaneous premeditation, the whole part of the instruction, where, as always emphasized by prosecutors, that you could be, if you develop the intent to kill as you are committing the killing, that's premeditation. That's inconsistent with Hearn. That's the rule that was adopted in Caslon and then repudiated in Byford. So a pre-Caslon use of a Caslon-type instruction has to fall, just as opposed to Byford one does. But I think what we need to focus on is here the quality and quantity of the mitigating evidence.
I'm puzzled by your claim that he has a gateway actual innocence of the death penalty claim under Schlupp. I'm not following that piece of your argument because he has another felony conviction, right?
That's true, but in a weighing state, it's not like the non-weighing states where one aggravating factor will do. You have to have the aggravating factors not outweighed by the mitigation, and that is part of the calculus. So that is
our... Then would every one of these cases become an actual innocence gateway? There's no bar?
That's the lesson.
I mean, that seems
Leslie.
To be
that's,
the upshot of your argument.
That's what happened in Leslie, Your Honor. And that was the ruling in Leslie. If you have a prejudicial error with respect to an aggravating circumstance, then you are actually innocent of the death penalty. That's what Leslie says.
Continue.
So I think in thinking about this mitigation evidence, consider the fact that I'm not a doctor. I barely know the difference between the temperature and a temporal lobe. But the doctors who have examined Mr. Crump and who have synthesized the mitigating evidence, they say he's got a brain impairment, which is what gives him this hair trigger temper, where he gets a headache, he gets mad, he hurts somebody. And all of his prior record is that. His ex-wife said, he's a Jekyll and Hyde. One minute he's fine, and then he blows it. Although, yes, he has a fairly vibrant prior record, this impairment would justify a jury in saying, now we understand why this person is like this. He didn't choose to be like this. This is something wrong with his brain. If you look at the other mitigating evidence, and there's quite a lot of it, if you look at the parts of the petition, which is over 100 pages, in pages 54, 48 to 55, 62, there is an immense amount of evidence of multi-generational alcoholism, depression, suicidal attempts, and things like the fact that Mr. Crump admitted at one point that his father stabbed him in the head with a screwdriver. It's not somewhere between 9 and 12. That's not happened to me. I can't say I know what that's like. That's why we need this evidence and these experts to interpret the relation between that brain impairment and what may have caused it and what the sequelae are, which are the offenses that Mr. Crump stands convicted of. I think in terms of what the way that the court rejected these claims with respect to the mitigating evidence, even though this mitigating evidence wasn't in front of you, or only a little bit of it in terms of expert testimony, was that there was no ineffective assistance because Mr. Crump, who is mentally ill, said, "Don't talk about my mental illness." I don't think that can ever be ineffective assistance. I don't think that can ever constitute effective assistance. And in any event, to the extent that there is a default arising from the refusal to raise that at trial, Mr. Crump can overcome that because of exactly this innocence of the death penalty theory, which is afforded by Leslie and by Flute. I think that this court, at this point, having seen this evidence, and I urge the members of the court to look at this because this is a horrendous tale, which is supported by friends and relatives and records from his childhood all the way through his incarcerations. This is someone whose ability to control his impulses is very different from ours.
And isn't this, though, I mean, look at the crime that occurred here. Doesn't it look more like premeditation than an impulse issue? I mean, he actually bound this woman, put her in a bathtub, filled the tub up, or started to fill the tub up with water, and made statements afterwards. It smacks me of something other than an impulse issue.
He makes statements both ways, Your Honor. But it is also something where when you have this lack of brakes in your brain on your behavior, there is not just impulsive behavior which is acted on immediately. There is perseverance. There is being unable to back off and say, I need to stop this. It's both impulsivity and perseverance in the impulsive behavior that is what is wrong with Mr. Crump's brain.
Counsel, does that mitigate his own words? He said, I didn't have to kill her, I...
Yes, he said a lot of things, Your Honor.
It was premeditated.
He said a lot of things in his statements, including confessing to a murder that never existed. So at the point where you are talking about a suicidal individual who is talking about asking for the death penalty when he's talking to the police, I think we have to take, this is why in this context it is more important than ever that the lawyer who is appointed to represent the individual knows what's going on before acceding to a defendant's wishes.
Do you think Leslie's consistent with Schlupe, or do you think there's a disconnect between those two cases?
I think it is consistent with Schlupe in the sense that if what we're talking about is eligibility for the death penalty, which is what Schlupe is talking about, I understand Leslie as being about the same thing.
And you don't think it's using language that's inconsistent and more generous than Schlupe?
It may be, but I don't think in this case it makes a difference.
Okay, thank you.
So, Mr. Pichetta, are you asking us, and it's interesting because we heard a case this morning that has similar underpinnings, and I'm not putting the two cases together, so please don't mistake my question for that. But are you suggesting that there be a different qualification for counsel who represent these type of individuals above and beyond the 250 qualification?
Oh, I think there should be. I think this court should be developing that by reversing these cases on a systematic basis. It doesn't really matter what the qualifications are in Rule 250. It doesn't matter what the performance standards that the court has adopted say. It doesn't matter when this court makes pronouncements and opinions about how much you value the quality of habeas litigation. If you refuse to enforce it, what you are doing is training these lawyers to say, yes, it says I have to do investigation before deciding on strategy or before deciding to accede to a defendant's wishes, but they're never going to hold me to it, so I don't have to do anything. And I'm already over my time.
That's all right. We've asked you some questions. Complete your response.
Actually, this court is in a unique position right now because you have what is called the backlog of cases. I think of it as a backlog of due process in the death penalty cases, where you are seeing now more than I think any court ever has before. Appeals from initial habeas proceedings, appeals from successor habeas petitions, appeals from direct appeals from convictions and sentences. If you ask your staff to look at the appeals from initial habeas petitions and ask them, do those petitions, do they look like this? Are they petitions with no allegations of evidence outside the record, with no experts hired, with no investigation conducted, which we refer to them in our shop as old school habeases, which are just a rehashing of the appeal. I think if you ask your staff to go and look at all the cases that are presently before you, the cases that are on successors where we have found this much mitigation, are usually preceded by initial habeases in which nobody does any investigation. That was 20 years ago. It was 10 years ago. It's 5 years ago. It's last year. People are still doing that. And no one is held accountable because it is all considered, well, it's Mr. Crump's fault for not wanting mitigation. It's the mentally ill guy who is at fault. I think that, yes, the difficulty has been it's very hard to find people who will do this seriously. And really, that's the problem, I submit, that is partly caused by this court's failure to hold people accountable by saying, yes, we can't say a reasonable jury wouldn't have found a different result if somebody had actually worked this case who knows how to do habeas. And that's the problem, I think. Thank you.
Mr. Van Bosker.
Good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Van Bosker. I represent the state. May it please the court. We've been litigating for 30 years what trial counsel had exactly one weekend to prepare. On a Friday before a Monday trial set, Mr. Crump decides he doesn't want to represent himself after all. This court has held there's no right to the effective assistance of counsel where there's no right to counsel. As such, Mr. Crump had the right to one weekend's worth of effective investigation. And he was warned about that outcome at the beginning of the process. When he first says, I want to represent myself to Judge Thompson, the judge says that's a really bad idea, gives him time to think about it. The judge has the case called back on a different day, has Mr. Meyer, who will be trial attorney, sit down and speak to him for an hour and a half about the dangers of self-representation. The court then does an extensive Feretta canvas. The court then takes the unprecedented step of going over a document the judge himself prepared for Mr. Crump. The document goes over all of the reasons why a defendant shouldn't represent himself. When they come to the part about post-conviction remedies, the court has Mr. Crump read it aloud on the record, and then asks him, what does it mean? Mr. Crump tells the court, If I feel later that an attorney could have did a better job for me, I can't holler that it was wrong to let me self-represent myself. Yet here we are, 30 years later, and he's still hollering. The district court correctly denied the third petition because there was no showing of good cause and prejudice. There's no good cause here because every allegation of ineffectiveness related to mitigation or mental health is a direct consequence of Mr. Crum's choices. On appeal of the second petition, this court found no ineffectiveness of counsel because Mr. Crum forbid any defense that brought into question his mental capacity, prohibited a mitigation investigation, and barred contact with his family. Why is that? Mr. Crump has been absolutely consistent from day one that he did not want his mother to know what he'd done. In his confession to police, he says, if this is a death case, I don't want my mother to testify because that would be akin to premeditated murder. His courtroom outburst about the cameras is because he doesn't want his mom to see him on TV. During the evidentiary hearing on the first petition, the trial counsel testified that Mr. Crump would not tolerate any defense that brought him to question his mental capacity, would not allow a mitigation investigation, barred contact with his attorney, with his family, and would not allow a psychological evaluation. During the litigation of the second petition, first post-conviction counsel was deposed. She says that Mr. Crump will not allow a mitigation investigation or contact with his family because he doesn't want his mother to know what he's done. Now, on page 10 of the reply brief, defense complains that this argument is belied by the record. They argue that because Mr. Crump allowed this type of investigation by third post-conviction counsel, he surely would have allowed trial and first post-conviction counsel to conduct the same investigation. That argument ignores the record. During her deposition, first post-conviction counsel said that after the petition is litigated, she's moved to California. Mr. Crump calls her and says, my mom's in the hospital. Will you please go talk to her? Counsel does, and then she says a few days later, Crump's mother dies. So the reason he didn't allow this investigation had nothing to do with his mental health and everything to do with the fact that his reason for prohibiting it in the past no longer existed. Nor is there prejudice to waive the procedural bars. On appeal of the first petition, this court described the evidence of guilt as overwhelming. On appeal of the second petition, this court described the death eligibility evidence and the other matter evidence as damning. On the basis of that damning and overwhelming evidence, there would be no change in outcome if all of the evidence from the third petition were available at trial. The jury would still face a man with three prior first-degree murder convictions under his belt, who admitted the killing in this case, and who presented with what this court described as an incredible history of violence. But the real point of this appeal is that Mr. Crump cannot be allowed to abuse the process. He cannot, on the one hand, hide what he's done from his family, and on the other, blame his lawyers for respecting his wishes.
You want us to actually say the part where he withholds the mitigation evidence, the same as concession of guilt, not guilty by reason of insanity, and Feretta self-representation. All those things are really up to the defendant. If they do it, it's tough luck for them. If they then come back later and say, I now want to challenge the conviction or the penalty phase.
Well, let's keep the record in context here. This wasn't Mr. Maurer saying, well, whatever you want, Mr. Crump. Mr. Crump had been evaluated at the beginning of the process. They did a competency evaluation. In 1984, Dr. Masters evaluated Mr. Crump and found that he was competent. He said that he could pass all of the memory tests accurately, that he appeared goal-oriented, that he could talk about his case, that he understood what was going on. And let's not ignore Mr. Maurer's personal contact with the defendant. Recall that he sat down and spoke with Mr. Crump for an hour and a half about self-representation. And Mr. Maurer testified during the evidentiary hearing that he started to explain to Mr. Crump about a new case from the Supreme Court. Mr. Crump cuts him off, pulls it out of his paper and says, I've got it right here, I know what I'm doing. That doesn't sound like a defendant who has mental health issues. That sounds like a defendant who knows what he's doing. There was no basis for Mr. Maurer to question anything Mr. Crump was telling him.
Later on in 2008, he was evaluated by Dr. Mack. And Dr. Mack is the one that indicated he was unable to control his impulsive anger and this impulsive condition made him substantially unable to conform his conduct to the requirements of law. And that, I believe Mr. Pichetta is pointing to as a miscarriage of justice to overcome part of the procedural bars.
It's not. Let me explain why. To take advantage of actual innocence, you have to establish new evidence that undermines the aggravating circumstances, and you have to have an underlying constitutional violation. That is not new evidence. In the litigation of the second petition, both Dr. Globus and Dr. Schmidt testified that Mr. Crump could not premeditate. Let me give you the cites on that. As to Dr. Schmidt, it's 9AA 1969. Dr. Globus, it's 9AA 2004. So it's not new. All Dr. Mack has done is connected, expanded on the prior diagnosis and connected it to documentary evidence that's been collected. But the idea was litigated in the second petition. The district court denied it, and this court affirmed that denial. So there's no new evidence. And additionally, there's no underlying constitutional violation here. Because again, this was Mr. Crump's choice. It wasn't a symptom of his mental health. He wanted, as trial counsel said during the evidentiary hearing in the first petition, trial counsel said that Mr. Crump would not tolerate a defense that brought into question his mental capacity, and he would not allow mitigation investigation, and would not allow contact with his family because at all costs, he did not want his family to know what he'd done. We may question the wisdom of that choice, but there's no basis to question whether he was mentally competent to make that choice. Have I answered your question, Justice?
You did. Thank you.
Is there any other questions?
I don't think so.
I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case will stand submitted.